Imagine looking at the official historical record, like, I don't know, a massive crime scene.
Right, like the state has just come in and scrubbed the walls completely clean.
Exactly. They've washed away all the fingerprints, and then, decades pass, historians walk through that pristine room entirely unaware of what actually happened there.
Because the evidence is just, it's simply gone.
Yeah, it's gone. Until someone walks in with a black light, suddenly all these hidden stains are illuminated, and you realize an entire group of victims has been, well, totally erased from the story.
It really upends our whole assumption about how history is preserved, doesn't it?
It really does, because in 1979, an actor stepped onto a London stage and essentially turned on that blacklight. He did something that academics had failed to do for over three decades.
He exposed a forgotten Holocaust.
Yes. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are looking at our source material today, which centers around a really landmark 1979 stage play called Bent. It was written by Martin Sherman.
And for you listening, our mission today is to explore how this single piece of theater didn't just, entertain audiences, it actively unearthed a buried chapter of human history.
Right, the specific targeted persecution of homosexuals in Nazi Germany.
And honestly, for you, as someone who values gathering multiple perspectives, this is just an absolute masterclass. It shows how art can actually leapfrog academic research.
Yeah, when the institutional avenues just totally fail us. So let's look at the cultural landscape when Bent premiered, May 1979, the Royal Court Theatre in London.
We are talking about a massive historical vacuum here. You really have to place yourself in the mindset of the late 70s.
Right, because the Holocaust was universally recognized, obviously. The persecution of Jewish people, Romani people, political dissidents, that was all documented.
But the specific, systematic rounding up of gay people, that was practically invisible. There was like a tiny trickle of historical research available.
Almost nothing.
Yeah, almost nothing. The broader public awareness simply wasn't there at all.
Which makes the title of the play itself such a sharp provocation. I mean, the word bent, it comes straight from a British slang term.
A slur, really.
Exactly, a slur for homosexuals. It's abrasive. It signals right from the marquee that this play isn't going to politely ask for your attention.
No, it demands it. And what's so fascinating is how a play like this actually changes history. It didn't just reflect the past. By putting a human face on this, statistical void, it gave audiences a vocabulary.
It created the demand for the academia, right? Like it told historians, hey, look here.
Exactly. And it worked. The play actually helped spur serious historical research on the topic throughout the 80s and 90s.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit because the production really did not hold back. The original 1979 cast featured Ian McKellen starring as the lead character, Max.
A phenomenal performance.
Oh, massive success. It transferred to the West End by July. But Sherman knew a history lesson wouldn't shock audiences into understanding, right? He couldn't just tell them about the persecution.
He had to drop him right into the exact moment the trap snapped shut.
Yes. Berlin, 1934. The narrative plunges us into an environment that turns lethal literally overnight. We meet Max, played originally by McKellen, who is this wealthy, promiscuous gay man living with his boyfriend, Rudy.
And in the underground scene of Berlin, they're living pretty freely.
Right, despite Max being estranged from his family. But then one evening, much to Rudy's resentment, Max brings home a handsome guy named Wolf. And Wolf is an SA man.
The Sturmabteilung, the original paramilitary wing of the Nazi Party.
Right, and this is where the macro level political shifts bleed directly into their personal lives, because the specific night Max brings Wolf home.
It happens to be the night of the long knives.
Yeah, the historical turning point where Hitler orders the ruthless assassination of the SA's upper echelon.
To consolidate his absolute power, replacing them with the SS. So the power dynamic in Germany flipped in a matter of hours.
The relatively open underground culture was just instantly criminalized. The very next morning, the SS burst into Max and Rudy's apartment.
And they discover Wolf, the SA man.
And they execute him right there, right in the apartment.
It is such a terrifying sequence because the characters have no idea the world has changed overnight. Max and Rudy are forced to just flee for their lives.
They run to Greta, this drag queen who owns a gay club where Rudy actually works. But when they arrive, the club has been shut down.
Implicitly due to the due enforcements of paragraph 175, the law criminalizing homosexuality.
And this interaction with Greta, I mean, it's chilling because she isn't a safe harbor at all.
No, totalitarian states don't just use violence, they corrupt the social fabric.
Mm-hmm.
Greta coldly reveals that she's the one who gave the SS Max and Rudy's address.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, She fires Rudy on the spot, hands Max a portion of her finder's fee, and just tells him to leave.
It's completely jarring. So then they turn to Max's uncle, Freddy. Now, Freddy is also gay, but he has a totally different survival mechanism.
He lives a deeply closeted life, maintains this flawless public facade while secretly using rent boys.
Right. And Freddy actually manages to get new capers for Max to flee to France, where homosexuality is legal.
But Max refuses the papers.
Because he won't leave Rudy behind.
Exactly. So what does this all mean? We have three different survival tactics here. Greta's betrayal, Freddy's hiding, and Max's loyalty. Which one actually works?
Well, it's horrifying to analyze. In a healthy society, Max's fierce loyalty is a profound virtue. But totalitarianism completely inverts human morality.
So Greta's absolute betrayal is the only thing that keeps her alive.
Right. Freddy survives by erasing his identity, but Max's deeply human loyalty. That is the exact thing that seals his doom. They end up hiding in a forest tent colony, and the Gestapo inevitably tracks them down.
Which brings us to the transport train headed for Dachau. And I have to be honest, running through the source material on this sequence, it is profoundly unsettling.
It's the crucible of dehumanization. The captors need to strip away everything before they even reach the camp gates. Yeah. On this train, an officer spots Rudy wearing glasses, just a normal pair of glasses, and he forces Rudy to physically crush his own glasses and then takes him away to be beaten to death.
Yes, potentially just for having poor eyesight.
Right. The arbitrary nature of the power is suffocating. Any reaction from Max would mean his own immediate death, so he just sits there.
Complete obliteration of the individual. And this is where Max meets Horst, another prisoner wearing a pink triangle. Horst warns Max to show absolutely no emotion regarding Rudy.
And here's where it gets really interesting. Or maybe terrifying is the better word. Max makes a calculated choice when he's interrogated. He lies.
Yes.
He claims that he is a Jew rather than a homosexual. Wait, I'm stuck on this. He lies and claims he's Jewish because he genuinely thinks it will be safer for him in Dachau than wearing the pink triangle.
He does.
That completely flips everything I was ever taught about the Holocaust victim hierarchy.
It is a staggering historical detail. We are so used to viewing the Holocaust through the accurate lens of anti-Semitism. But within the camp system itself, the hierarchy was incredibly rigid.
So claiming Jewish identity was viewed as a better option.
Comparatively, yes.
Yeah.
It speaks volumes about the absolute bottom-tier status assigned to homosexuals in that ecosystem. They were pariahs, even among the persecuted.
But the cost of that lie, what Max has to do to prove it, the guards bring the dying Rudy back to Max, and Max is coerced to beat his own boyfriend to death.
If he hesitates, they both die, and Max gets the pink triangle. He is forced to become the instrument of his partner's execution.
And as if that wasn't a total destruction of his humanity, Max later confesses to Horst that the guards took it a step further. They forced him to have intercourse with the corpse of a dead preteen girl.
Just to prove his heterosexuality.
Right. It's devastating.
If you look at what Sherman is exploring, it's the total destruction of morality.
Mm.
Survival required Max to hollow himself out completely. He arrives at Dachau physically alive, but entirely dead inside.
Which makes the shift in the final act so remarkable, because arriving at the camp actually marks a shift toward reclamation.
Yes. The physical environment is a nightmare, but their internal mechanisms begin to resist.
Max and Horst are assigned to work together, just moving heavy rocks back and forth in this meaningless loop. And in the middle of this absolute hell, they build a connection.
Max with his yellow star, Horst with his pink triangle.
They fall in love. But if they touch each other, they'll be shot on sight. So they become lovers purely through their imagination, through their words.
Two men doing backbreaking labor, never making physical contact, but communicating so deeply.
It's like they build a sanctuary of virtual reality in their minds, a profound act of defiance where the guards cannot reach them.
And within that fortress, Horst continually tries to pull Max back to his humanity. Horst wears his pink triangle. He refuses to hide.
But Max is still hiding behind his yellow star, still crushed by the guilt of what he did to Rudy.
Until the climax.
Mm-hmm.
The guards shoot and kill Horst.
And standing over the body of the man he loves, Max finally makes a stand. This man who went to the most unimaginable lengths to avoid being identified as a homosexual, he takes off his own jacket.
And puts on Horst's jacket, the one with the pink triangle.
Yeah. And he walks over and commits suicide by grabbing the electrified fence.
What's fascinating here is how the play frames this. It is a tragedy, both men are dead, but Sherman writes it as a moment of profound reclamation.
He finally stops running.
Exactly. By putting on that jacket, he's loudly declaring, "This is who I am." He chooses to die in his own truth, He finds the dignity that lies in acknowledging who he truly is.
It is powerful beyond words, and a story with that much visceral weight, it couldn't be contained to just one stage in London. The global ripple effect of Bent is fascinating.
It immediately became a cultural flashpoint wherever it was produced.
Later in 1979, it hits Broadway. Richard Gere takes on the role of Max. The next year, it's in Brussels. It's in Germany. But here is the one that really stopped me in my tracks. 1981, Bent was performed uncensored in Brazil during a strict right-wing military dictatorship. How does a play like this make it to the stage under those conditions?
That is a brilliant anomaly. It highlights the blind spots of authoritarian regimes. The censors likely viewed a narrative about gay men as too marginal to be a legitimate political threat.
They simply didn't understand the subtext.
Right. By dismissing the marginalized identities, the dictatorship inadvertently allowed a massive anti-fascist message to be broadcast completely uncensored.
That is incredible. They totally underestimated it. But then you contrast that with places where the subtext was understood. It caused actual riots in Israel in 1983 due to the subject matter.
But then it survived there five times.
Yeah. Right?
Most recently in 2018.
Yeah. And then in 2009, an Amarillo, Texas production was shut down when a Christian group called Repent Amarillo tipped off local law enforcement and the venue lost its lease. Why does this play remain a lightning rod decades later?
Well, looking at it objectively, Art the Challenge is deeply held societal norms and forces a culture to confront its own historical amnesia is always going to generate extreme friction.
That makes sense.
It forces audiences to look at the uncomfortable intersection of sexuality, state persecution, and societal complicity. For some, like the revivals in Israel, it's a necessary excavation of truth.
But for others, the explicit nature clashes with modern community standards.
Exactly, sparking outright opposition. Like in Texas, it proves the themes hasn't been safely relegated to the history books. They're still touching raw nerves.
A raw nerve is exactly what it is, and the legacy just kept building. In 1997, Sean Mathias directed a film adaptation, and there's this brilliant casting detail.
Well, this is poetic.
Right. Ian McKellen, who originated the role of Max on stage back in 1979, returned for the film, but he played Uncle Freddy.
The older, deeply closeted uncle who tries to help Max escape.
While Clive Owen played Max and Lothair Bluteau played Horst. It's like the actor who first brought this history into the light is passing the torch to a new generation.
It creates a beautiful continuity, ensuring successive generations don't allow the past to be erased again.
So, to pull all of this together, Bent took a slang word, a totally buried piece of history from 1934, and turned it into a global phenomenon. From London to Broadway, slipping past a dictatorship in Brazil, sparking riots in Israel, uproar in Texas.
It really forced audiences to confront the uncomfortable realities of the past.
It's the ultimate proof that when the official blueprints of history are missing entire rooms, art is sometimes the only tool we have to rebuild them.
Which leaves us with a final lingering thought for you to mull over. If a play written in 1979 was required to finally uncover the hidden history of 1934, it makes you wonder.
Yeah.
What marginalized histories of today are currently only existing in underground art, just waiting for their own version of Bent to finally bring them into the light?
That is a profound question to leave you with as you examine the blueprints of our own era. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the official record. Keep looking for those missing rooms, and we will catch you next time.